Interim Committee on Veterans Affairs will come to order.
I am opening the informational hearing for the House Interim Committee on Veterans Affairs. We'll begin this meeting with an overview of the House and Senate committee concepts, the individual number LCs that might come before either these committees, and finally hear a brief description of agency concepts. We ask everyone to be brief in the descriptions and concepts, and please hold questions until each presenter has finished. To be clear, we're not discussing the merits of the concepts, just a brief description and concepts that may come before either of these committees as bills. Once we've heard the summary of the LCs, we'll recess and reconvene separately and hold work sessions to introduce our respective committee concepts and then continue with separate informational hearings. First of all, I'd like to have Senator Anderson. I'll recognize her.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Co-Chair. That's right.
We still have co-chairs.
Chair, if you wouldn't mind.
I usually like to start the Senate Veterans Military Affairs Committee with usually something from sayings or little vignettes that are actually written by veterans. And I did that all, it focused on the Oregon National Guard and what they've gone through last session. But this session, I want to focus on women. And, you know, before 1973, women comprised less than 2% of the U.S. military. And now, as of 2010, it might be higher now, they were 14% female. The percentage of women varies per branch. While women constitute 19.6% of the Air Force, they're 14.9% of the Navy, and the Marines only have 6%. Yet in the reserves, the numbers are much higher. Overall, women make up 24.1% of the reserves and 31.3% of the Army reserves. And so, as you know, at least I really do feel that we need to put more attention on some of the things that women go through and, you know, in the military. And so this book that I'll be talking about in the Senate, sorry, House, you won't be able to participate or hear about these, but these are portraits of women who are combat veterans, and it's called When Janie Comes Marching Home. And I was really taken with some of the comments, because you have, at least I did, stereotypes, because I did not serve, although I did fly in and out of Vietnam, picking up GIs and taking them to the R&Rs. You sometimes get this stereotype of women, you know, and they struggle with that. But it's so gratifying to read about the bonds that they form, and boy, their units, the support for their own troops is so strong. I mean, so these will be vignettes on motherhood, pregnancy, opinions on war, relationships with their units. But the capacity for women to serve in the military is, I think, unbelievable. And the bonds that they felt for their fellow troops is so strong. I'm not going to read any more about this, but these are some of the things that we're going to bring up. I was on the task force along with Representative Cowan on the task force for women's health in the military. And we learned a lot, and I truly believe that there's not enough emphasis on women in making this transition, this cultural transition of accepting them in the military and them serving the military. So I don't have really an agenda, but just to share and give food for thought for some of the things that I will be sharing with the Veterans Committee on Women in the Military. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. I would like to do one quick thing for myself and for you. Would all the veterans please stand? Ladies and gentlemen, let's thank these people for what they have done. Excuse me. Channel, would you summarize our House veterans bills?
Well, good afternoon, Co-Chair Escobedo, Co-Chair Witt, Chair Boquist, members of both committees. House Veteran Affairs Committee has 7 LCs that they are planning to introduce when we reconvene next door after this informational hearing. The first is LC 1684, which would give college credit for certain examinations, such as the college-level exam program, to veterans who adequately pass those tests. LC 1718 would allow all veterans to receive in-state tuition, even non-residents. LC 1719 would ask the OMD, the Oregon Military Department, to develop a study and a pilot program for the use of therapy dogs for veterans who have sustained injuries such as PTSD. It allocates $75,000 for a study involving 5 dogs and 5 veterans. LC 1720 is a memorial to Congress advocating for full funding for therapy dogs for veterans and for overturning the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs prohibition on funding therapy and service dogs for veterans with emotional and mental disabilities. LC 1722 would appropriate $1.1 million for the Campus Veteran Service Officers Program. LC 1723 would allow a spouse who moves to Oregon due to a military transfer to have the opportunity to also transfer their professional certificates and licensures if the board has evidence of competency, if it is a similar licensing structure, and if the military spouse has been practicing 1 out of 3 of the most recent years in another state. And finally, LC 1725 would waive the 12-month residency requirement for service members, active service members, so that they would receive in-state tuition rates.
Thank you. Cheyenne, do we have any questions, first of all, of any of these bills thus far? Okay. Any clarification? Okay. Cheyenne, would you summarize the Senate vet bills?
Thank you, Chair Escobedo, Chair Witt, Chair Boquist, members of both Veterans Committees. On the Senate side, we have LC 461 relating to service members, requiring courts to consider a defendant's veteran status during sentencing in criminal cases. This is on behalf of the Oregon State Bar. LC 462 relating to contested case hearings requires agencies to inform active service members of their federal right to stay administrative proceedings under the Service Members Civil Relief Act. This is also for the Oregon State Bar, and it should be noted that most agencies do this already. LC 1088 will not likely be re-referred to one of the Veterans Committees. It's on behalf of the Fire Marshals Association relating to smoke alerting devices and seeking to conform smoke detector statutes and codes. LC 1089 is relating to dispensing fuels in an emergency. It creates an exception to allow self-service at capable gas stations during declarations of emergency. LC 1091 is also not likely to be re-referred to one of the Vets Committees. It is relating to charitable checkoffs, adding a checkoff box on the tax return form for volunteer firefighters. It is on behalf of the Firefighters Association. LC 1158, relating to veterans, requires law enforcement training on veterans' issues. LC 1159, relating to emergency management, requires background checks on emergency operations staff. LC 160, relating to the Oregon Military Department, creates a task force to study the utility and feasibility of mobile command centers. LC 1666, originating with the Madam Vice Chair, Mona Anderson, is a resolution urging Congress to develop a means to disclose military convictions for sex offenses. LC 1831 relates to tax credits to hire qualified veterans and creates a tax credit for hiring qualified veterans. And LC 2157, relating to 911 emergency communications, provides authority to organize Oregon's public safety answering ports regionally.
Thanks. Any clarification?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I want to make a clarification, and we'll cover this in our own committee, but since we're doing it jointly here, for the liaisons for the veterans groups and the lobbyists, get your pencils out so that you write these numbers down. The Senate actually has 4 placeholder bills that are in there so that you don't have a cardiac arrest and we don't get the EMTs in here. 1158, 1159, 1160, and 2157 are placeholder bills, just so you know, because I'm sure we'll get someone from law enforcement sending stuff, and just for your edification, and we'll cover that in our own hearings. But I wanted that to be put out, so if you do have a question, you can come at, you can contact the committee administrative staff, Cheyenne, and she can give you some more details. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Boquist. Now we're going to move on and let our members speak about their bills. I believe Representative Boone, you have 3 bills, and you'll have about 5 minutes to give us a dissertation.
Can you go ahead and let somebody else do it, because I didn't know that they were printed, they weren't printed up, right? No, okay, so let me just identify them.
Representative Matthews, you have a couple.
I do, Mr. Chair, thank you, and for the members of the committee, I'm looking at a furthering the no wrong door effort that we made last session with the effort that we made using BOLI and the ODVA. It's been very successful, so we've been meeting with DHS and DMV, and rather than just a passive card at the front desk, it will be a question asked of a veteran, and again, further identifying our veterans, trying to access the $4.2 billion of unused monies right now that are for our veterans, so that's going to be significant. And another bill is on veterans affordable housing and working with the affordable housing communities, and Ryan Fisher has been doing a great job helping me with that. We're looking at that issue as well. So those are some bills right now. I don't have them for anybody to sign on to, but they are bills that will be pre-session filed, and I appreciate your opportunity, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions?
Mr. I just would like to point out that since Representative Matthews is with the United States Army formerly, he was ready and prepared to make his presentation.
Well, I'd like to point out, if it were the Navy running this thing, which it is, in great shape.
And I'm an ex-Marine, so
that's a minor part of the Navy. Go ahead, Representative Boone.
Okay, I have a bill that will that names September 27th First Responder Appreciation Day. A very housekeeping bill that OSPAC has put forward to change the date of the annual emergency prep drill to reflect the it will be in March on the same day that the Japanese earthquake occurred rather than in April that it is now. I have a, again, no sweeps bill on the 911 fund and a volunteer firefighters tax credit, which I see that there's another bill already in. We can couple up on that. And then I have a placeholder for the seismic bonds upgrade, for seismic upgrades for the bonding program that the voters approved of in a few years ago. And I've since discovered, since writing this bill, that the governor has in his budget some money to do seismic upgrades. So with bonding, so that may be taken care of. I do have the sheets if anybody wants to sign on to them.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions or clarification? Representative Parrish, I believe you have a bill.
I have a couple. So, and behind every good soldier then is also their very highly organized spouse.
Army.
Yeah, Army wife. So I will be bringing back the tax credit for communications for soldiers who were deployed. We passed that in committee last time, and it died in Ways and Means. So I will be bringing that back, and particularly given that we are potentially looking at a 2014 deployment of a big chunk of our troops, I think that's timely to make sure that spouses and families are not saddled with a $100 a month internet bill because the federal government doesn't have their act together. I am going to be supporting the school identification where we try to understand who are these kids. We are a non-based community, and so I'll be working with the Department of Defense on that. Bill, we've had a military child education coalition that Martha Schrader and I co-chair that effort in Oregon. That is definitely a priority for that organization and the community partners out there who want to help military children, but we don't know how to find them because we're not a base community. And then all of these things, colleagues, cost money, so I will be looking at long-term solutions to funding for veteran services and programs.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Clarification? Thank you. I do not have the bill drafted, but what I would like to work on, which I think is beneficial to every veteran from the state of Oregon, and we're going to discuss it today in our hearings, is the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs Mortgage Plan. As you know, currently ODVA, when you receive a loan, a home loan, you have that benefit for a one-time basis only. I would like to mirror the federal government in the aspect that, let's say, in 1970, you bought a house for $10,000, which was quite feasible in 1970. Well, these benefits keep growing, and maybe they're up to $400,000 today. The way the federal government on the federal VA does it is you continue on that basis, and then they deduct whatever you used out of that top end. That's the way Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs should be, because you're always a veteran and you'll always be a veteran. So therefore, that should be a continuing benefit for you as a veteran. The other thing that I can see that I'd like to see us do is roll that into not only would help ODVA with their monies, but I'd like to roll that thing back in to do refis at 100%, because we have so many people coming back that have problems with their homes, and I'd like to see that to be available as a tool for them to refi their home, whereas currently you cannot refi. So that's what my objective is, and I hope we can get it accomplished this time. So Representative Huffman, you had something as well.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One bill, it's being drafted right now on behalf of the Oregon Vietnam Veterans Association, and it would dedicate I-84 as a Vietnam Veterans Memorial Highway.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Senator Boquist, do you have anything?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Senator Olson, I believe you have one or two bills.
I actually have two bills. One is very similar to Rep. Boone's in that prevent 911 sweeps so that we just don't go in and take those monies. We want to make sure that we have that available for the 911 center. And then I have another bill that I introduced last year, which was next generation technologies for 911 so we can upgrade and make certain that if you're on the 15th floor, we know that you're on the 15th floor and it's easy to get to you. Those are the two bills I proposed.
Thank you, Senator
Monasanti. Yeah, actually, Representative Huffman stole my thunder. I don't know if we want to have two bills or, you know, or co-chief sponsor.
Senator, I'm more than happy to work, yeah.
Designating I-84 a Vietnam War Memorial Highway. And then, of course, the other bill I had that I've made as a committee bill is urging Congress to develop means to disclose military convictions for sex offenses.
Thank you.
Peter, you have one.
Senator Courtney? Veterans
I'm
bill?
I'm not going to introduce the bill to the committee, though. I'm not doing a committee bill. I'm not doing a committee bill.
Well, these are individual bills we're doing.
Well, I'm going to try to make a running at the, if you're a veteran, you get Veterans Day off.
Yes.
I'm coming back.
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you, Senator Courtney. Mr. Kocher?
Yes.
Anything for you? Thank you. Now we'll get into agency bills, and I'd like to call up General Caldwell from the Oregon Military Department. I guess you have a few bills.
Yeah. Oh, he's not anywhere.
Good afternoon, members of the Joint Committee on Veterans Affairs. Welcome. Welcome back. I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department, and we do have several legislative concepts we forwarded for your consideration in the next session. LC 595 deals with primarily the effects on House Bill 3490 from the 2011 session on workers' compensation for qualified search and rescue volunteers. This is basically house cleaning. It's a cleanup. It's the way it's written right now, according to our expert legal advice, is it could be very onerous in cost toward the state, as opposed to the intent of the bill was to ensure that local jurisdictions made sure they had their emergency management workers covered under workman's compensation. So we don't think it changes any intent. We just got to get the language square, and that'll be before you. LC 596 is a pre-disaster mitigation fund bill. And actually, we created a pre-disaster mitigation fund in 2008, and this is, excuse me, and designated as separate and distinct from the general fund. The statutory language has led to an inefficient process as it relates to the Office of Emergency Management Administration of Federal Grants. It's basically, again, more of a cleanup, more than anything that we're going to change substantially, but this will make it more efficient if we can pass the language in this statute correct. LC 597 is Office of Emergency Management, and it allows the emergency management performance grants that we receive from the federal government to also be available to the sovereign tribal governments here in Oregon. Presently, the way the law is written, they can't be considered for those grant funds. So that was also been an issue with the tribes over the years, and we want to try to get that fixed as well. The money's depleting rapidly, so there may not be much to pick from in this pot, but at least we believe they should be eligible. LC 598, seeks to extend the sunset tax on the emergency communications tax, 911 monies basically. It's currently a 75 cents per month for each circuit or device capable of accessing 911, and that sunsets in 2014, so we need to reauthorize it this session. LC 599 actually deals with prepaid telecommunication services. I know there's a competing bill or going to be a bill in the House that Representative Burr, I believe, is putting forward, and so this is maybe a duplicate, and we may need to get rid of it if we get that squared away, because she will introduce a bill and we will have that debate again on the prepaids. LC 601 permits suspension of certain contractual relationships for members of the National Guard, to organize militia in the Armed Forces and the Armed Forces of the United States, and this bill would prohibit penalties, fees, deposits, losses, or additional costs where service members suspend contractual services as a result of being ordered to report to active military duty. It's similar to what Co-Vice Chair Representative Parrish, I think it's on those same lines, and we may want to see where those meld together as well. LC 602 is basically a housekeeping measure that we are trying to fix in our Oregon Code of Military Justice based on some other regulatory changes and some other changes in statutes. And I don't know if it probably ought to start here, but it's probably going to end up in judicial, I would think. I don't know how exactly that works, but typically we end up in front of judicial because the OCMJ is dealing with our soldiers in a legal sense when they're under the control of the governor. And so that may be something we want to look at and coordinate with staff to see if that's the direction it needs to go. So it's basically clean up housekeeping. LC 604 relates to revolving fund payments. These, in our statutory language, again, this is housekeeping. We have a revolving fund statute. We haven't used this statute in probably 10 or 12 years. And that's mainly due to the way we account for things now and the way we do business with respect to DAS. And how our accountings go, that this is antiquated. We don't use it. We really can't use it and stay in legal format with the Department of Administrative Services and how we do our finances. So it's wasted legislation and space in the book, and we think it needs to go away because it hasn't been used. LC 605 clarifies which agencies are required to liaison with the Office of Emergency Management, and both through our coordination center that we run. This further designates who those folks are, clarifies it, makes sure they know that they're part of the Emergency Coordination Center and part of the Oregon Emergency Response Network. So it's kind of murky, and we want to get it clear. And that concludes the bills that we will forward to you, or we have forwarded to your staff for consideration in the next session.
Thank you, General. Any questions?
Just one comment, Mr. Chair, just for clarification of the audience, that the 911 tax being a tax issue will start in the House, and normally, because it's a House bill, it come our direction. So you can beat them up first.
Anything else? Thank you, General.
Thank you very much.
ODBA, Tom Mann.
Chairs, members of the committees, for the record, my name is Tom Mann. I'm with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. This session, we have a very small agenda, 7 bills. I think, believe you, they're having us come in with 20 to 25 because we've had task forces and those kind of very aggressive programs. There were no task forces this interim, and so I'm a smiling man. We have 7 bills. We have a couple fee bills within this, so let me go quickly through them. We have a conservatorship program, as you may know, that takes care of our most vulnerable veterans. Under statute, we can charge up to 5% fee. That pays about a third of what the private sector charges for regular charges for conservatorship. You may know that conservatorship is also something the private sector does. Our program is subsidized by our loan department by about $30,000 a month. So what we've been trying to do is get the conservatorship program off of the loan program. And so we have this LC 606 that would allow us to increase that fee to about a half of what the private sector charges instead of a third. We would still be significantly lower than the private sector, offering veterans a substantial savings in conservatorship, but hopefully get that program away from the loan department. LC 607 addresses exactly what Chair Esquivel was saying. It would eliminate the loan process of only two loans. It's actually, you can have two loans in your lifetime. We would eliminate that. You could use as many loans as you wanted, up to the $417,000 authorized by the federal government for these loans. And so the bill's drafted as LC 607.
Please finish.
Sure. LC 608, this is the bill that we talked about during the last interim committees. We have been examining getting into the VA loan guarantee business. To do that, however, you have to be able to do a loan at 103%. We're authorized by statute to do 100% loans. That extra 3% above the 100% is the guarantee part for the federal VA. It's how they almost insure the loan itself by taking this extra money in. So in order for the ODVA to do loan guarantee through VA, federal VA, we'd have to increase that 100% to beyond 100%. That's what the LC would do. LC 609 is a bill that would authorize the agency to do an administrative fee on some programs we administer, some pass-through fees that we do for some programs, as well as some administrative costs that we have for some programs we run. We did this bill before we got our governor's recommended budget, which we're extraordinarily happy with, and this bill will be something we'll all be discussing, but the bill's in, and you'll see it, and then we'll probably have a discussion whether we actually need to do administrative fees or not, based upon what the governor's budget and what the legislature decides on our budget. LC 610 establishes a lottery game for veterans' benefit. This is a bill we've all talked about before. It'd be a Veterans Day lottery ticket. And other states have done this very successfully. Obviously, we can only use it for education and economic development. We believe that would help our educational aid program, as well as help us find veterans to get them economic development through their VA benefits. As you know, only 86,000 out of the 331,000 veterans in the state are using their VA benefits. There's about 250,000 veterans out there that could use benefits. 612, LC 612, it's a housekeeping bill for our educational aid program. If you read the statute, it reads that it is an absolute entitlement. You shall provide this benefit to any veteran who asks, which is why the cost of the program has escalated over the past three biennium. We want to change that to as funds are available. Instead of it being an entitlement program. That is on the recommendation of LFO, and we agree with them on that one. So that's a little housekeeping bill. And lastly, we have LC 615. This allows our conservatorship program to be part of an existing statute for recovery. There is a statute under 115 that allows state agencies to recover from a state's costs borne by the state. We are not in that list. It's a list of about 12 different agencies. We'd like to be part of that list. We understand we'll be down at the bottom of it, but if there is state money left to pay off some of the charges that we incur that right now we're just eating for a conservatorship client from their estate, we'd like to be part of that list if possible. And that concludes our list of seven bills for this session.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. So on either of the mortgage concepts, I just want some clarity. Do they then, there's a thought that they would get their mortgage, they take out a loan for $270,000 house, pay that loan and fulfill it, move, and then they have the full flexibility of the $417,000.
They would have $200,000 left.
Okay, so
right.
That's.
You have up until that 417.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a deduction part of it, what you previously
correct.
Used. And by the way, look, when I did the ODVA back in 1971 or 72, you're only allowed a one shot at it. So obviously we've changed that to two, which means that I'm eligible for something. I'm not sure.
Come down and see us, Mr. Chair. We'll take care of you.
Yeah, there you go. Any other questions? Thank you, Tom.
Thanks,
I appreciate it, and I really hope that we can, in fact, get that mortgage thing squared away for our veterans. I would like to take some time here and thank Senator Anderson. Maybe we overlooked this a little bit, but, you know, when you're in Vietnam or when you're in Afghanistan or you're in Korea or wherever you're at, when you board that plane for R&R, you're still suffering from PTSD, I don't care who you are. And these ladies were so gracious to us and kind of stable to us, actually, and we appreciate that very much. So, without further ado, Senator, I'll turn it over to you.
Am I next on the list?
Yeah, you're next on the list.
Okay.
You want me to read for you?
No, I'll
you just move your lips and I'll read it.
No. I'm going to take the liberty because I have you guys stuck here and you can't drill until I hit my bloody gavel. So I do want to take this on behalf of all of the senators to thank our, because we're really in the last of the interim meetings as we are right now. And we on our side, of course, had military affairs and a few other items, so we sent you some few things you probably didn't like, but that's okay. But I do want to thank both Representative Escobar and Representative Witt and all the members of the House side for their efforts and their hard work on behalf of veterans. And I would say that, you know, we've started in basically 2005, and I think Representative Witt and I were started there, probably the only ones left at that time. And then some of came into the Senate, but we have had a nonpartisan or bipartisan, whatever you want, of veterans efforts in this building for session since at least 2005 forward, and it shows some of the progress we've made. Still a lot of hard work left to be made in the future, but I think all the senators on our side believe all of the representatives on your side still share that view that, you know, veterans is a nonpartisan, it's a veterans issue. I'd also like to take the opportunity, having beaten the daylights out of the governor's office, and Mr. Cameron's back there on veterans issues for 2 years in the governor's office, and I'd ask Mr. Mann to go back to Mr. Willis, who I've sometimes had conflicts with on behalf of veterans at ODVA, and said, hey, we need to get this thing fixed. Let's make it go away. And likewise, I'd like Brigadier General Caldwell to express our thanks to the members of his department and to the Adjutant General, General Reese, on behalf of at least the senators on our side for the effort that they have put forth. None of us all agree on everything, but everybody's worked together. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. You have any other final comments?
Well, I don't have any final comments now, Senator. I should never have let the Senate go first.
Army leads the way again.
Representative Witt, would you like to comment?
Well, I just want to say that I agree with Senator Boquist, and I think that both of our committees have been able to advance the interests of veterans, not only in our state, but I hope and set an example perhaps for some other states and things that we can do to make education, to make health care benefits, housing, a whole host of things easier to access for our veterans. Also want to say that, again, agreeing with Senator Boquist, this is not a bipartisan, but a nonpartisan issue. And I have been so pleased to have worked with a group of representatives who have, in every instance, put aside any consideration of partisan issues. I don't recall really a single time in our committee, Mr. Co-Chair, when partisanship has raised its head. And in every instance, the actions that this committee have taken have been in the interests of veterans, and I've been very pleased and proud to serve on this committee and to serve with the members of the legislature that I have. They have been an outstanding bunch of folks. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to say very briefly that these two committees are very productive. These two committees look out and have a special place in their heart for veterans, and that is why it's so successful. I think the indication here is that it's nonpartisan, that it is. It's all about veterans, and veterans are first and foremost, and that's the most important thing we have to deal with. But more importantly, I look at it very simplistically. If we're going to go and get involved in wars, then by golly, we better take care of the people that come home. So. Thank you.
Thank you, co-chairs. The Senate is going to be in recess and will reconvene at 14:45 hours. That's 7 minutes for Senator Courtney.
The House committee is...
come back into session, and we're going to actually gavel in again for the purpose of a work session in terms of legislative concepts. And I'm looking to see. I do want to go back and cover three quick things for the audience that's out there so that you know and you save ringing off the telephones that 1158, 1159, 1160, and 2157 are placeholder bills. Okay? And I think everybody I see out there knows exactly what a placeholder bill is. Okay? And for the audience that doesn't hear that's on that funny camera up there, a placeholder bill is basically a bill held in place that has a relating clause in it so that we can deal with issues that we anticipate in coming into the session. With that, Madam Vice Chair.
Chair Boquist, I move the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 461, dated 9-28-12. LC 462, dated 9-15-12. LC 1088, dated 10-2-12, LC 1089, dated 10-3-12, LC 1091, dated 9-12-12, LC 1158, dated 9-18-12, LC 1159, dated 10-16-12, LC 1160, dated 9-28-12, LC 1666, dated 11-29-12, LC 1831, dated 10-05-12, and LC 2157, dated 11-07-12.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Madam Vice Chair Montes Anderson has moved the legislative concept as recited be introduced as committee bills. Two points I need to point out to committee members. A vote in favor merely is for introduction of legislative concept. It is not a vote on the merits of the concept itself. It is not indicative of a member's opinion or position in any means whatsoever or on the content. For members of the public that, as I see, we have out here, but mostly on the tape that are watching at this time, how the process works in the legislature is the legislative concept is brought forward. It is then drafted into a bill, and then once you have the bill, it is at that point that you would have a public hearing in it and the discussions of the bill. There may or may not be amendments that come forward. If there were and the bill were to go forward, you would then have a work session. Those amendments would be introduced in the work sessions, debated in the, amongst the members, and then gone forward. So this is really a procedural function that we go through and all committees go through it at that time. Is there any discussion on the legislative concepts? Senator Courtney?
No.
Senator Olson?
No.
Madam Vice Chair?
No.
If there is no discussion, is there any objections to any legislative concepts? Seeing no objections, the concepts will be introduced as committee bills. And with that, we'll move on to our agenda, for which we're about 15 minutes ahead of schedule right now. And we're going to have an informational meeting for the purpose of doing some reviews, the 201 review, World War II Memorial review, Academy changes, SB 241 update, and lessons from Superstorm Sandy. And these will be very short updates, and we're going to go ahead and move into the informational portion on 211. And are they here? All right, they're here. Please come on down. And please, for the record, introduce, and then whoever's in the lead, take charge.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair Boquist and committee. My name is Lisa Lenz, and I'm the director of 211 Info. And we're a statewide organization that provides information referral services over the phone and over the web for people seeking basic health and human service community information. And we wanted to give an update on a pilot project that we're currently involved in that's really aimed at serving military services personnel. And part of this project came to pass as about a year ago, we had different advocates, community organizations, local governments, philanthropy organizations saying, you know, there's not really a one-stop place for people seeking veterans-related services and basic services in the community. So if somebody needed health care from a general community health clinic and somebody needed information about something specific to military services, there wasn't really one stop that had both of those services together. So we were asked to think about what it would look like if we were to create a more targeted part of our service aimed at military services folks. So with help from the governor's office, we met with a couple local foundations and pitched the idea as a pilot project, and we're fortunate enough to receive funding from the Meyer Memorial Trust to help enhance and develop a program over a year. So we hired Deanne Osorio, who will speak in a moment, to help us build out our database with military services information, and then to begin a pilot project that will start as a texting program actually designed to focus on returning National Guard families who may be more inclined to have the anonymity of the texting experience, and younger families or any of us who are around, anyone in the 20-something range knows they're more inclined to use texting or social media as opposed to a phone service. So it's an opportunity for us to launch a program in a slightly different way than we've done before, and really to create a comprehensive statewide database that goes beyond basic needs, but really builds out and provides information about military services. So we are excited to take this project on. Deanne's been with us for about 2 months and brings a wealth of experience prior to working with us, had worked at an Army OneSource, so really brings that knowledge and that depth of connections within the military services family. So I will let her talk a little bit more about the specifics of the program.
Senator Boquist and committee, my name is Deanne Osorio. I am the wife of a 21-year combat veteran. He did two tours in the Middle East, one in 1991 and one in 06-07. He was with the Stryker Brigade that was deployed out of Fort Lewis that was extended to a 15-month deployment. And I worked for 3 years with company called Serco, which is a third-party administrator, on a contract called Army OneSource. I did about a year and a half in both the states of Washington and Oregon for a total of 3 years. And we raised two kids in the military. So I kind of have a pretty good idea of, you know, what military families go through when it comes to deployments and those kind of things. So the services, I did a lot of volunteer work, and I also managed those volunteers. So I bring a lot of experience and a certain love for our veterans and our military families with me. And I'm happy to report that right now in our 211 database, we currently have over 180 military-specific resources. About 25 have been added over the last 2 months that I've been here, with more to come. And we hope in the future, as Lisa said, to have a texting number that people can text to for veteran-specific resources, and also possibly a military services specialist who would answer calls and then answer specific questions, somebody who would maybe know about benefits and those kind of things. And we're also hoping to launch a web page that is similar to the San Diego 211 info page. If you get a chance and wanted to look at that, it's a model that we would like to use, where there's links and write-ups and things that would be very helpful to our younger generation who may not want to call but may want to just do that search online for themselves. And we thank you very much for your time, and we will now answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, and thank you for coming and giving us an update. I remind committee members, we kind of, 201's a much broader entity, and we asked them to look at the veterans issues for this, because they serve as an information brokering house. And not only does it help veterans to be able to say, okay, this is who you need to talk to, and then they put them in direct contact with that, but it's also in a lot of other areas. And as I think Senator Monas-Sanders and I have discussed multiple times and trying to move forward, is sometimes you have these overlapping agencies, and if we can get down to the focal point of, okay, get it to the right agency, get it to their first time, we can start eliminating that duplication. And so this is interesting. It's been unfolded across the state and the utilization that it's had. And, of course, veterans is not their primary focus. It's, again, this brokering information house, and to get them to the right source in the state versus the individual's got to make 6 calls, gets frustrated, and then doesn't call anybody. So any questions for there? Senator Olson.
Oh, never mind. I just answered the question. I read it, and I said, I saw that you serviced active military families, and then I went on and said, and veterans, and that's what I was concerned about.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you very much, ladies.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It. We're going to move on to the World War II Memorial. Nicole, I think I saw you out here. I don't see Nicole. We'll skip World War II Memorial because she's probably double duty on the far side, and move to Academy training changes from the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. and ask them to come forward. And this is actually a pretty good evolving. This is a case where the committee had raised issues, and the old days of BPSD had raised issues, and they started working towards training programs. And a case where we don't have to do legislative action and just communications between agencies and us and everybody else and the sheriffs and the police, and things start happening in a positive manner. Please go ahead and introduce yourself. And
Chair Boquist, Vice Chair Montes Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lieutenant Rob Anderson. I'm a class training coordinator for Department's Public Safety Standards and Training, otherwise known as DPSST. On behalf of the director, we first of all, we'd like to thank you for giving us the time to come tell you about where we're headed with our veterans training. I'm a military veteran. I currently have a son serving in the Marine Corps. So as this program came to my attention, I jumped on board to really try to help this, because when my son did return, I saw some of the changes that the veterans are going through. As you know, Oregon doesn't have a full-on military base like other states do to help their returning veterans. So we got together and created a committee involving the Oregon Military Department, Veterans Outreach through the VA, Salem Police Department, members of DPSST staff that are current combat veterans, veterans from law enforcement itself, and the VA Police Department. And we just basically got together saying, what is the need for our first responders? What can law enforcement, telecom, corrections, what do our first responders need to know about veterans returning? And it goes beyond our current combat veterans, but also veterans of all eras. So how can we as first responders not only meet their needs, but how can we go beyond meeting their needs to help them out in those times of crisis when we as law enforcement are called where they're having issues? Originally, we came up with a two-hour volunteer program that was an optional program that at DPSST that was headed by Veterans Outreach, where they came and talked specifically about PTSD, traumatic head injuries, and really focused on where can we as law enforcement, public safety, where can we get veterans the help that they need, whether it be during a crisis or even if we come in contact with somebody that we feel could use veterans assistance. As law enforcement, who can we contact? Who can we get a hold of to let the VA, let Veterans Outreach know, here's an individual that although they're not in crisis yet, they may be headed that direction. So how can we get that information out? The class has been held three times currently. Approximately 75 members of DPSST basic students have attended, including basic police, corrections, and telecommunication. As I said, some of the key factors in that original two-hour program was PTSD, major head trauma, some of the indicators that they may see in veterans that are having issues, and it was presented by Linda Matty with Veterans Outreach. Reintegration of combat veterans was an important piece of it also, not only for the public, how are we going to integrate returning veterans, but how are veterans that are in the field of law enforcement, how are they going to come back from the restraints they had in a combat situation, coming back to the laws and restraints that they have as a law enforcement officer, and how can law enforcement maybe see their coworkers having these issues, having problems, and where can we send them to get help? The emphasis was placed on the fact that most returning veterans are okay. They come back to society, they become members of their community, and they're fine. But what do we do with the members that can't? We didn't want to focus in on all military veterans have this issue, but you know, here's some things to look at and that they have that understanding. Phase two of the program came in of what can we give law enforcement specifically an advantage of being able to see and know prior to even that contact, how can they tell that a person may be a military veteran? So we created a veterans awareness program, which is a two-hour program that focuses on that initial contact, on the traffic stop, seeing those indicators, for instance, maybe dog tags hanging in a rearview mirror or license plate frame, some of the bumper stickers, T-shirts, tattoos. So how can a person have that initial contact and know, you know, you may be dealing with a combat veteran, and in many cases, these veterans and military folks, they're trained better than we are. So how can we not only acknowledge their service, what they've done for their country, and in many times we're finding that just those small acknowledgments can help lower the anxiety rate that they may have simply having contact with public safety and law enforcement. So we designed that class, again, focus on the veterans that need assistance and giving officers that pre-indication of, you know, here's what you can look for. Between May 2012 and October 2012, a joint committee of city police, county sheriff's office, state police, a civilian member of the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training began a review of the entire 16-week basic police curriculum. During that time, it was determined that the committee wanted more focus on mental health type issues. So we looked at it as a great time to be able to now this, both of these classes, both levels will be added into the basic police 640-hour mandatory hours.
Thank you.
Chair Boquist, Vice Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Captain Teresa Plummer, and I'm the Academy Training Supervisor at DPSST. As you've heard from my colleague, DPSST is not only committed to providing veterans training at the Public Safety Academy, but we also have expanded our focus to include regional and advanced training classes to our law enforcement officers working in the field. Beginning in 2011, as discussions were underway regarding this issue, we recognized that there were two areas that needed to be considered: law enforcement officers responding for calls for service involving veterans, and educating agencies who hire and employ returning veterans. In the past year, one of our regional trainers, Lieutenant Mike Herbus, has delivered 8 regional training classes across the state. The class concentrates on working with returning military veterans. We also have 6 classes scheduled in February of 2013 in various cities along the I-5 corridor. This training is being done in partnership with the Veterans Outreach Program. Lieutenant Herbus has a long history of service in the military and is still a sergeant major with the Army Reserves. This class follows the same format that we teach to the basic academy students. In addition to our training commitment, we have partnered with the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association to broadcast training announcements for regional training sessions that are being held by the Oregon National Guard and the Department of Veterans Affairs. They are actively involved in providing this training, and we are proud to be a part of that. DPSST is also offering website information to all of our public safety partners for a free 4-hour online training class called Treating the Invisible Wounds of War, provided by Army OneSource and hosted by the Odom Institute at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Its purpose is to build bridges between local community resources and military families and develop a better understanding of the culture in which veterans and their families live and work, and to provide best practices for identifying, assessing, and treating mental health disorders that result from the trauma of war. Thank you for your time today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mayor, very much. And I appreciate the effort, and please extend it back to the department director, because we started 4 years ago with nothing, and now we're in a place where I've actually been to one of your regional training sessions. I've actually been to one in your facility across town here. And, you know, the chiefs of police are on board, sheriff's association on board, superintendent's on board now. You guys are getting online and doing this stuff, and we're finally making rapid progress in this area, and we haven't passed a single law. It's all a matter of everybody communicating between each other and trying to say, hey, let's go help veterans. This makes sense. I mean, everybody knows what happens when you get an agitated veteran that does have PTSD, and it's the police officer needs the training, and you need to de-escalate the situation. And so it's been good for everybody. But it's been remarkable on this particular issue where we bantered them around, everybody, chiefs of police, everybody, and everybody said, yeah, we're not doing as good as we job, and we've actually had positive results going the exact direction we need to be going, and no bill was passed, and nobody got beat up other than their feelings a little burnt in the committee, but that's okay. And I don't have any. I just really appreciate it. Madam Vice Chair?
I just feel this is so valuable. I mean, if you can do this education and implementation in the state of Oregon, I mean, mental health and community health, mental health is so important to me, and we so lack proper education to the general public. So if we can start with the focus on military, hopefully then that can even branch out to the rest of the population. That is, you know, I mean, the tragedy that happened at Clackamas Town Center, there are going to be people there with post-traumatic stress.
Absolutely.
But anyway, thank you.
Chair Olson, comments? Senator Courtney? Thank you very much. And again, please convey our thanks to the department.
Yes, sir.
I'm going to go ahead and move to SB 241, Oregon Department of Veterans, and hopefully Nicole's here. There's Nicole, okay? Because I don't see
the other Nicole.
The other Nicole. I don't see Nicole squared here yet, so.
Nicole squared.
Right. Nicole 1, Nicole 2.
Oh, and Nicole.
Slow.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nicole Hoft. I'm the Public Information Manager for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And I'm here today to provide you just a brief overview of the implementation of Senate Bill 241, which directs the state agencies and food banks to make reasonable efforts to ask their clients and their constituents if they are a veteran. And if so, to provide them with some information on how to obtain their veteran benefits. So in response to the directive, what ODBA produced is, you should have something in front of you. It's a 40-page magazine that contains all state and all federal benefits that are available to veterans. We also developed a blog that I wanted to pull up online, but it looks like the World War II memorial video is queued up, so I won't bother with that. But we did migrate this information that's in the magazine to a blog, so it's accessible online as well. We chose to do a magazine for a few reasons. ODBA has a lot of printed brochures on different benefits, but there's nothing that contains all veteran benefits in one document. For example, we don't have information that we can give to veterans on property tax exemptions or fishing and hunting license or even on the dependent tuition waiver. So if we have a veteran or a spouse or a dependent in our office, we don't have any printed materials to give to them, and therefore other agencies didn't either. So with this magazine, if a veteran is standing in front of a service provider, for example, at DMV, the person serving them can give them this magazine, and the veteran can read through it and know if they qualify, if they're eligible for a benefit. And we think that the likelihood of that veteran contacting ODBA or one of the county veteran service officers increases if they know that the benefit is available and that they already qualify for it. Since the end of August, we have distributed 28,000 magazines. This is huge. We've distributed them to state and federal agencies, our county veteran service offices, VA medical centers, including vet centers and all the community-based outpatient clinics, veterans and other partner organizations. We're actively meeting and working with the food banks right now to distribute to their 20 regional network providers. And that's a massive undertaking, so that's taking a little bit more time to get those on the ground to the food banks as directed in 241. Just want to review really quickly, if you don't mind, a little bit about how the magazine is organized. For example, if you turn to page 28, you'll see veteran employment. And what we did is we took an opportunity through this magazine to educate veterans about some of the benefits that they receive that isn't like in a traditional benefit form. It's bills that are passed by this body, educating them on their employment rights. Last session, we passed the public employment interview for veterans. So there's a little bit of information about that. So we really, like I said, took this opportunity to educate the veterans about what is available even through statute. One other thing I'll point out is in the back, now that the veteran has all this information, what do they do? That was a big part of when creating this magazine. Give them a point of contact. Tell them where to go and how to get this benefit. For example, the Oregon property tax exemption. If you look in the directory, you'll see that they need to contact the county tax assessor or revenue office. Or for Fish and Wildlife, there's a website that they can go to and download the forms. Military records and medals, we get that question a lot. We gave them a direct website. These are all the recommendations that a veteran service officer would make directly to a veteran if they came or if they called us in the office. Wanted to mention that, and I actually want to note on the record that working with the agencies when we reached out to begin distributing these, it's been amazing. They've been very responsive, very eager. They want to get this information. And so on the record, we want to thank the agencies for their assistance in helping us reach further into the community to reach the veterans.
Could I ask you, because we don't have video up and the long-term record is audio, could you cite off the webpage you made mention on page 4 of the webpage and the email and the Facebook for the record so that those that are listening and don't have access that they can actually know what to go look for if they don't have a copy of this?
Absolutely. Thank you. The website is www.Oregon, spelled out, DVA, as in Department of Veterans Affairs, .com. So very Oregon. OregonDVA.com. The website for Facebook is facebook.com/ODVAVET. And our normal website, which is a little lacking for information at the moment, but that website is oregon.gov/ODVA.
And we appreciate it. And I remind members, you know, one of the intents of 241 is we're trying to get as many veterans as we can on federal benefits so that we can, it has a positive fiscal impact on us.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
Here's another step, you know, we're going in that direction because we haven't been able to fund sufficient number of veteran service officers across the state. And so we continue to make progress in different ways. And having the ability to, that they can track it down quickly and then transfer that not only helps the veteran, but it helps the rest of the state in terms of what is going on. Questions, Madam Vice Chair?
No, that's great.
Questions, Senator Courtney? Mm-hmm. Senator Olson?
I do have a comment. I actually had a constituent that is a disabled veteran contact me about reduction in their property taxes, mm-hmm. and I noticed by I'm thumbing through your magazine that it is available. Mm-hmm. And if I could get another one of these, I would forward that to
Absolutely.
My constituent.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
I'm being educated on techie stuff. A guy who doesn't even have a cell phone is getting educated on techie stuff. Do you have is there a blog related to this or anything like
that? It is a blog, and that we have a unique URL, and that's the OregonDVA.com.
Okay.
That is the blog, and it does have complete links. All the information that we lead you to through the directory has the links right on the blog. So.
Right. I have grown up teenagers. That's what I use for technology. If I have to do anything, I get my daughter, who's 24, to come over and fix it. So, thank you. Again, we appreciate it. Thank you for the update. We're going to move back to the World War II Memorial, and I saw Nicole come in with guests, if you would, please. And you can, and just identify your name and introduce yourself and go on from there.
You bet. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lou Jaffe. I am president of the Oregon World War II Memorial Foundation. The charge of this foundation was to duly honor Oregon's World War II veterans through this memorial project. And to that point, I want to thank members of the committee for their support and Representative Matthews in ushering through a request for $250,000 for this project. I understand that will be taken up in the February rebalance. So I thank you all for your support. In a short video that you're about to see, it will become apparent that this project will be much more than a static fixture. Through robust educational features, we'll be able to allow future generations to learn from and be inspired by compelling stories of perseverance, service to country, duty, and honor, and shared sacrifice. It'll be a compelling story briefly. Briefly, the status of the project is as follows. We have a budget of $1.2 million, against which we've raised $140,000 in cash and in-kind donations. We have firm commitments of $250,000, and we have a request before the legislature of $250,000. In addition, we're actively going before the major donors, businesses, foundations, and the community at large for support for this project. Our objective is to get it dedicated no later than December 7th next year. And now we take a look at the video. That'll explain more completely what we're about.
We're ready for the video.
But it's not projecting. Do we take a brief recess, Patsy, or? Go find a 14-year-old.
Bring heckier than me.
I can certainly give you copies of a DVD to watch at your convenience.
Well, if we had the DVD, we could. Well, I have my
laptop. She's going to call.
You're going to call me.
Do you want to go on and we can come back to the video? The video is your closing.
That's pretty much the closing.
Great.
I wanted to give you a quick overview that of the project. Which is to say it is substantially more than a static memorial.
40-20. So nationally they're projecting 33% of the grade, or the jobs will need a bachelor's and above.
Wrong.
I don't think that's right.
No, I just
needed
the control.
Go ahead, sorry. Okay. Technology at its finest.
I understand.
You have five people up here that don't know technology well.
The young lady doesn't feel alone, I gave a presentation at lunch today in Portland at the U.S. Naval Academy Association, Alumni Association. My video worked great, my audio didn't. So,
can't win.
But we're out in the community wherever we can go. Tonight we have an event at the with the Portland Correction, the Pacific Northwest Defense Coalition, trying to get some corporate sponsors. This is a very compelling project. Nationally, World War II veterans are dying at the rate of 2,000 a day. And when one, as you may have, as I have, meet with World War II vets and hear their stories, this is a chance to really give them life and share them with future generations through internet technology. And the point I wanted to make is while we have individual stories of heroism, sacrifice, and courage, woven together, those are great lessons of citizenship. And we believe, and we'll have that opportunity to create that for young folks.
Okay. We appreciate it. Do you have a few minutes?
I sure do.
Because I'm not going to recess like she suggested, but if you have a few minutes, then I'm going to bring General Caldwell and the Colonel up here and have them, and we can move on to lessons from Sandy, and then when we get a tech up here that can fix this bloody thing,
great.
We'll come back to it. That way we make sure we see it.
Sure, thank you very
much. If you just give us 10 minutes
that's fine.
At the best, and that way you don't get robbed if you trip up here. And I'm not going to be outdone by the bloody Navy either. So.
Thank you very much.
Because there's nobody from the Navy.
Did you catch the way she said that? Hit the Windows key and P.
I got it.
I thought that's where we started to laugh.
You have to hold down the windows.
It has four alternatives. We need the main gentleman.
Yeah.
You can write down their instructions. I'll leave that up.
Please have some from media come up here. Tell them the chair is insisting now. Okay. General, you used to pinch hitting. This is nothing new about you.
No. I keep my video slides right here on this little thumb drive. So
definitely. Lessons from Sandy.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. With me today is Lieutenant Colonel retired Marty Plotner, who is now been appointed as the Director of the Office of Emergency Management within the department. And I'm going to let Marty do a good deal of the discussion on Hurricane Sandy. I will, if you don't mind, back up just a piece to a couple of earlier comments. Certainly the World War II, my father was a World War II veteran. But fascinating enough, Mr. Chairman, you mentioned earlier in the first part of the hearing about the nonpartisan nature of these veterans committees, which we certainly appreciate. And you commented back to 2005. Just yesterday, a friend of mine called me and he said his father's a 91-year-old World War II veteran. He graduated from Salem High School. He did not graduate from Salem High School. He was drafted just before he graduated, about 6 months before he graduated in 1942. And he went into the Army, served in World War II in the Pacific Theater, came back, never got his degree, never got his high school diploma. And he was telling me this story, and so I told him, I said, you know, the legislature passed a law not too many years ago that basically said that if you have a DD-214, you can show that to the school and you can be issued a high school diploma. And I couldn't remember what year it was, but I started in 2005 and my computer found it, gave him the citation, found it in the law, gave it to me. Today he called me and he said, I've talked to the school and they will issue it next week. And they've been giving him a little bit of a runaround. So again, just one little anecdotal story about taking care of an old veteran who desperately deserves it and he wanted to get it to him before Christmas because he's not in good health. So kudos for the Oregon legislature and the work you did back in 2005 that contributed to that. So, yeah, thank you very much. Back to Hurricane Sandy. As you know, we all saw it in the news. The New York area and the New Jersey area and all of the East Coast got hit extremely hard during the hurricane. couple of anecdotal issues that I think are interesting for this committee to consider and think about. One, when we have the major disaster that's going to hit here, we most likely believe, as you well know, and you've sat here and listened to briefings before, and that will probably be the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. Unlike this event, where they actually had notice, and one of the things that was noted in some of the after-action reports, which we have not been able to get very many of them at this point because they're still busy digging out, so there hasn't been a tremendous amount of real thorough AARs being done. But one of the absolute things that we do know from news reports and other meetings that Marty and I have been listening to on teleconferences, et cetera, people were told to evacuate in the lowlands, and they didn't listen. They said, this is not, you know, we've been here before. This is a...
Brookings, does this ring a bell to you?
And they were told to evacuate. They said, pack up, get out of there. You're in a danger zone. And they didn't do it, which created a tremendous burden on emergency services to go in and take care of them after the fact. And, of course, all those services were down. Cell phone towers were down. What really worked very effectively, believe it or not, more than one occasion was Facebook and people getting on Facebook and giving messages to a public service answering point, 911 center, picking it up off Facebook and then dispatching crews to go help people from Facebook because they couldn't communicate any other way. Texting also is another issue that works really well. Unfortunately, without our next generation being put in place, we can't use texting to 911 centers here in this state, as you well know. So there was a lot of those workarounds that occurred, but people should have listened to what authorities were telling them. They didn't. Mm-hmm. Currently, the estimate right now for New York is over $80 billion. For New Jersey, it's around $40 billion, or maybe $46 billion, I think it is. So clearly, those are first estimates of what this disaster is going to cost just to get back, and it'll probably be decades, and probably decades before that happens. Last thing I'll point out is that New York, not unlike Oregon, passed laws that says that each county's got to have an emergency plan, and each county's got to do certain things, and we monitor that and enforce it to the best of our ability. And in Oregon, all counties do have plans. But New York's law went a little further than that, and they actually predicted this particular superstorm. New York did. Unfortunately, though, they pulled the funding. This was about 12 years ago when they passed the law, 12, 14 years ago. And after about 4 years, they didn't fund it anymore. And so much of the planning that was done initially was stale and hadn't been updated based on current changes because they didn't have the money to do it. And the last point I'll make and then let Marty walk through the handout that you have in front of you. There's also a study was done by a university, I don't remember which one, but from a political payback situation, they concluded that there is no value in pre-funding disaster mitigation and or disaster processes. There is huge political value in coming in after the fact. Katrina, now this. And they said it's just a fact of life in America. And I think we would all agree to that people don't really think it'll happen to us. Not unlike the mall yesterday. I'm sure there's a lot of people saying, I thought it never happened to me in Clackamas County. So with that, I'll turn it over to Marty and let him talk a little bit more about some of the things that we've been able to pick up so far from this particular disaster. Go ahead, Marty.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, member of this committee. For the record, my name is Martin Plotner, and I am the director of the Office of Emergency Management for the Oregon Military Department. The event... Superstorm Sandy, as it's being called today, covered 24 states and saw a variance in climate that has not been seen before. A hurricane colliding with northeastern and whiteout snow condition that has both first responders and scientists reconsidering the effects and the mitigations for climate change. A few statistics for you. Out of the 24 states affected, about half of a survey conducted on the affected areas. Half of the survey respondents reported minor disruptions to their operations of the storm, but no long-term effects. 23% experienced only minor disruptions during and after the storm. 19% experienced major disruptions during the storm, but only minor after effects. And only 6.8% of the 24 affected states reported significant and continuing major disruptions. So with that 6%, 45 days later, in the state of New York, their Emergency Operations Center remains activated. The New York City Emergency Management is activated. There have been 2.7 million cubic yards of debris removed in the state. There are 67,000 residents that are still in transitional sheltering.
How many?
67,421, to be exact. There are 2,204 residents that are still checked into hotels. There are 6 shelters open with 309 occupants and 30 points of distribution, 2 fixed and 28 mobile, that are still patrolling in and around New York. In New Jersey, their operation center is in enhanced operation still, and they're estimating that they have 7.6 million cubic yards of debris that remains in over 10 counties. There are 30 points of distribution and disaster recovery centers open in the state of New Jersey. To date, there's still, as of today, there are 6,580 FEMA personnel deployed to 11 states. Half of FEMA Region 10 in Bothell is in the region right now, conducting either recovery or supporting response operations.
So we shouldn't have a Cascadia right now, I'm saying.
It wouldn't be a great time, sir. So in the essence of time and clarity, we put together just some minor stats and some lessons learned that can be applied as we see it. We've broken it down into a number of categories, including transportation, housing, communications power, public-private partnerships, and federal support, followed by a little mitigation. Again, as the General Caldwell stated, there is no real official lessons learned that's been conducted to date because half of the states that are still affected haven't even moved into recovery operations. So let's start with transportation. In the first 3 weeks following Superstorm Sandy, 475 million gallons of water have been pumped out of the transit systems in New York City. This equates to 819 Olympic-sized pools. Despite pre-positioning of certain assets and pre-notification, we have still seen massive fuel shortages and people that didn't receive first responder help for 7 to 11 days. Transportation systems across the country are still old and vulnerable, and our infrastructure is older and harder to replace. The power grid runs more than just lights and computers. It also powers heat, hot water, and water in all high-rises across the cities of New York and other major cities on the East Coast. And it also operates elevators that elderly and disabled rely on to escape their homes when they become unsafe. And remember, this event had pre-notification. In the area of housing...
Let me ask a transportation question. Because if you think geographically of what transpired in the statistics you just put out there, which aren't good, by the way, but if you look at that, it's a relatively, correct me if I'm wrong, a relatively flat area with a very intense transportation network. And we were to face a similar event, we have neither a robust transportation area. We have a mountain range between us and a whole series of passes. And so if you were doing the SWAG or the IPV, Intel Preparation of the Battlefield here, you'd be looking at the geographic aspect of this and looking at what transpired and saying this would be a whole lot worse in Oregon. Am I missing something here? Because you don't have the abilities.
I would concur, Chairman. It would be a whole lot worse, and you'd see pockets across the state and across the region that did or did not have support, that were and were not isolated, and that would what Sandy has basically pointed out for us is the difference between it and Katrina. Katrina had a flat geography, but it was spread out over miles. This was condensed into kind of a large geography, but a very high populated, dense area where transit systems were very interdependent upon first responders. So Oregon, if you were to take the two and combine them, you have a little of both, without the benefit of having a mass transit system that scopes much beyond the city of Portland.
I might just add that the metro system in New York, they shut down about 12 hours before mm-hmm. this thing hit. Had they not done that, it would probably have been a lot worse. Not when they were concerned about the viability of the system once the storm hit, but more importantly, they had millions of people that travel that system every day, mm-hmm. and they didn't want them stuck inside the city trying to get back to where they belong. So that was a brilliant move on their part. In our situation, as you aptly indicated, we've already scoped out the bridges. We know where the highway routes are. We know where the bridges are. We know where the likely slides are. And we also have factored into the fact that we're going to be days, if not weeks, perhaps months, being able to use over-the-road transportation to get to the Oregon coast, given the scenario. We're going to have an equally as difficult problem because the predictions are that the earthquake will be impacted here in the Willamette Valley, particularly the Portland metro area. I thought it was rather interesting as we were doing the tsunami cleanup and some of the things we were doing here this fall based on the Japanese earthquake. There was an article in the paper that I just happened to notice that the Department of Transportation, Oregon Department of Transportation, was showcasing two bridges that they just completed in Lincoln County down by the Siletz River that are completely 100% the latest, greatest earthquake sound bridges in the world. And Japanese were coming over to study that because it was such great technology. So kudos to ODOT. Problem is, they're the only two bridges on 101 that have that capability. Now, it's good that they had the two, and it's good that we're doing that, but the the whole, and I forget what ODOT briefed us, but I think it was around 200 years at our current rate to get every bridge taken care of in the state of Oregon, and I think that was here in this area. And then
yeah, we're like 352 bridges are toast.
It was just, yeah. And so I think when you look at what our biggest concern is going to be is, one, getting resources out to the locals on the Oregon coast. We look at it as probably the only way we're going to be able to do that is aviation, helicopters. We won't have to get in there first with helicopters, secondly with fixed wing. So it's going to be a massive challenge to mitigate or to recover or to respond to these challenges, and which is why we stress, and all the county manager, emergency managers up and down every county in the state, but particularly on the coast, educating to make sure people have those resources that they can survive. Not 72 hours, that's what the feds say. Well, we're saying you ought to plan for at least 2 weeks, because it could be that long that you have enough food and water to last for 2 weeks.
Thank you, Governor.
Yes, sir. Now moving on to housing. Unlike Katrina, New York City already has a 95.3% occupancy rate. So temporary housing, hotels, and rooms are not available, and they don't have the geographic space to set up temporary shelters. One of the lessons learned from FEMA with Katrina was they purchased thousands and thousands of trailers. They had problems with the trailers, and then they had to pay to get rid of them, and it took months for them to take on. In this, it's actually quite a good success story. FEMA, in conjunction with the City of New York, created a program called STEP, which stands for Sheltering and Temporary Essential Power, which basically allowed for the individual damage that's allowed at $31,000 per household, allowed private companies to come in, assess the damage, and then install power, hot water, and essentials in their residents if they didn't have water damage and other aspects, so they could actually shelter in place with power, with water in the cold. So it's quite a big success story. They still are servicing about 67,000 of those temporary shelters that we referred to it to date today.
Harder to do in Seaside.
In the next area, communications, power, and connectivity. Large success story from the federal government standpoint on the ability to pre-position utilities. We'll talk a little bit later on the public-private partnerships with the utility companies. Big success. They were able to resume power at a very quick rate when it came to critical infrastructure and businesses. However, on the opposite side, they're still really struggling when it comes to individual residences and stretching that requirement out. Communication still remains quite a challenge. People relied on social media, texting, and other variables because the system was not only reduced due to the storm itself, but it also was maxed out due to the number of personnel utilizing those venues. If you were to take what Senator Anderson mentioned before with Clackamas Community yesterday, even that incident there at the mall, which was tragic, it reduced the cellular ability of the responders and the locals for hours following that incident, and people inside couldn't even let their loved ones outside be notified via text because the system was flooded just with that one incident alone. So it's a good lesson to be learned when you consider communication as it stands.
Just a note for whomever we might think in the future of getting the, because we know we have cows and we know they have cow capacity. And the question is can the cows be integrated in with law enforcement so that they can put up additional towers on short notice? Because they came to us and claimed they could do it very quickly. Mm-hmm. They take their cows, what, cells on wheels, whatever this thing was. They call it a cow, right?
Right, cell on wheels.
They can do it within a few hours, Senator.
They can?
They yes. can.
Well, it depends on where the cow is.
Yeah.
And presently, Verizon, I know, has a cow sitting in Beaverton.
Right.
So they're fairly close, and I think they've got another one down in Medford, I believe, or Eugene.
Remember, we told him he'd have to fly the cows, and he thought we were all nuts.
Right. Okay.
Go on, thank you. I'm just trying to make notes for the future.
It's quite all right. In the area of neighbors helping neighbors, communities working with communities, it's been found both in Superstorm Sandy as well as the tsunami in Japan as well as recent smaller incidences that local community connection still is making success tenfold what it is when you have isolated pockets that communities aren't helping each other. When they know each other, it allows the churches and the faith, nonprofit organizations, Red Cross, Salvation Army, and community groups to step in, and they know where people live, they know how to help them. And in many circumstances with Sandy, people were actually carrying up goods on multiple floors because the elevators didn't work to make sure that they knew their neighbors and those pockets of population were covered. as leading right into the public-private partnerships, there's never going to be enough resources to rebuild the way that anyone would want to, but that doesn't mean we can't rebuild together stronger and safer with resiliency. Engaging the whole community and using transparency when it comes to utility programs, private industry, and government is going to be the critical piece in the future. Every decision must be made to ask that one question, which is, what are we doing in rebuilding best for the community, and how do we sustain it and not sacrifice those short-term gains for long-term recovery?
You'll notice in your handout there's a picture of an Air Mobility Command C-17 with a private entities. Actually, it was PGE out of California. That truck came out of California, was airlifted into New York to get power company trucks in there faster.
The one, because government services have to work hand-in-hand with that private industry, it's the only way that we're going to be able to get that done. The Stafford Act can only get the minimums done. It's never going to replace that community back to the way it was before the incident. One of the big success rates on the federal side was, for the first time, with the prepositioning and the other efforts that were made with HUD and other federal agencies, to date now, over $1.3 billion has been distributed between small business, public disaster areas, and individual disaster areas. Huge success story. 9 times out of 10, it's taken 3 to 6 weeks just to get the packets in, and then 60 to 90 days to get those things started. And at day 45, we're significantly into that. But some of the issues and the concerns with that are the same nimbleness that we've been able to apply from federal to local that hasn't really applied when it comes to recovery. And there's still many, many concerns, specifically in the area of West Virginia. They've been waiting 5 weeks now for over 300,000 residences to be evaluated on whether they qualify for individual assistance or not. And they've been waiting on a federal decision to move forward on that.
Let me ask you a question on this. And I see your picture, which is quite political, and I don't want to get into it. But here's the difference that I'm wondering, for lessons learned for Oregon. Mm-hmm. We have floods all the time. I mean, the Sandy River floods, and, you know, the governor does a declaration, and the FEMA bubbas come down, one or two of them, and we do all this. The locals call you. We go through the whole chain that we're supposed to go through because we have disasters all the time. So to us, it's kind of like old hat. Big argument, of course, during the election cycle here, because everybody, the locals suddenly didn't think they wanted to have local control, even if there was a earthquake or a tsunami. Quite a discussion during the election cycle on this here in Oregon, and it's like, okay, you're not going to have Seaside's not going to be there. I hate to be disrespectful, so you really got to get over this issue. But is there, have you looked at them and say, because I mean, you don't hear about, I don't know, the garbage dump overflows in New York and there's a disaster. You don't hear a lot about disaster, or West Virginia. You don't hear a lot about disasters in West Virginia. Is part of this is that there isn't in place the infrastructure or the knowledge and how to go through the process, and whereas we flood and snow and do everything all the time, do we have an advantage? I mean, I hear the horror story you're saying for West Virginia and some of these others, but have you looked at it to say they don't have as many and we simply do it better? Is there any advantages to that at our end?
I would argue that I don't know that we do it better or worse, but I would argue that this thing is so massive, and it was just included so many millions and millions of people because of the size of New York City in itself and that whole eastern seaboard, that I think, unfortunately, probably West Virginia is on the tail end of the chain simply because of the mass, you know, just the volume of this. And as Marty indicated, you know, 40% of FEMA Region 10 folks are back there right now and have been for 6 weeks. And I suspect that every region in the country is experiencing the same situation. So I think in our case, where most of our disasters have been fairly localized and they're not widespread except for the 96 floods, as you recall, and in that instance, we had similar issues. We had similar issues in the sense that we couldn't get people to every single county. OEM couldn't at the time. They weren't with us, the military department. We were assisting in all of this, and they couldn't get out there to get it, number one, because of transportation, and two, we didn't have the people. And that was, I think, exactly what we're seeing there. Our office has got 48 folks in it. We're probably 80% federally funded in those 48. And they don't do this business every day. Only two people, actually, two accountants and one manager, does this exact thing you're talking about. When we have the disaster, they got to quit what they're doing, and then they got to fold in and have another job. And therein lies, I think, the challenge. We just saw it a year ago out here in, when we had the flood out in, just south of here. And it wasn't a big deal, but it was big deal to those folks that got hit. And Marion County was, and we were very fortunate. We were out there immediately. It was small enough we could handle it. Still, it took, 3 months to get money flowing to those residents? 90 days, and we were small and nimble and handled it very gracefully, I think, but it still took that long for this system that FEMA's got set up to get those resources down to those individuals. Very frustrating for those folks.
Thank you, Ron.
I would actually concur with the general on that and would add the entire structure is built on that nimbleness and the adaptness of the local and county. Oregon is not unlike that. And so if the localized agency and the county is organized and understands how the process is supposed to work and can get in front of it on that side, they have a lot bigger chance of success. Many of the federal agencies that are deployed right now on the East Coast are sending individual teams because the locals don't have the infrastructure, don't have the training, don't have the plan in place, so they don't even know what to do. And that takes a lot more time as well. Mm-hmm. Finally, when we look at the second part of that, which is basically what happens after the disaster, which is the mitigation at work. And there's two examples for you on the last slide that basically shows a great success in Rhode Island. It's called the Fox Point Hurricane Barrier, and this was created about 10 years ago. And this actually reduced the damage that Rhode Island was reduced to wind damage and some minor storm damage in their state compared with the adjacent states around them because they had this barrier in place, and it was funded because of a disaster about a decade prior to. On the left-hand side, you see the some pre-drawings of some mitigation ideas already being discussed there in Manhattan that will reduce the wave impacts to the Manhattan area if this happens again and if they start that mitigation process. How that relates to what we're all talking about, which is what does that mean to us here in Oregon? Some of the big things in the lessons learned include the key importance of plans, training, and exercises and having those relationships all the way from the top to bottom and not exchanging business cards during the event. That first and foremost is number one. Second is the communication and the need all the way from 911 services to basic communications. Our society relies very heavily on that at all levels, at the first responder, at the citizen level, and at the government level, and we have to be prepared that it's not going to exist and practice our exercises as if it doesn't exist. The last thing is they're discovering at the federal level that they need a lot more streamlined processes at the federal level, coincidentally, to better understand. Right now, the general citizen, the state government, and hardly any elected officials really fully understand the complexities and the different types of grants, the different rule allocations, the different funding mechanisms and streams and timelines that do not all pair at the same point. And so there's a lot of attention being drawn on that, including a House bill called 2903 that's being introduced right now at the federal level to allow FEMA some more of those flexibilities right now, because a lot of their constraints are based on the limitations that they've been given underneath the federal government. So they're really looking at that now. Following that, I'll take any questions.
I'd love to be optimistic on that issue, but I think all of us, but we've been talking joint for, I don't know, since the end of the Vietnam War, right?
Yep, Senator.
And we are about as joint as we have know their cell numbers and they know our cell numbers, and nothing is integrated.
About as close as it gets.
It's about as close as it gets. I think the important part is, you know, getting the information out to the first responders, and so that they start thinking. And the other takeaway I see immediately is that there's going to be an allocation of resources and there's going to be rationing.
Correct.
At some point, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think about what happened yesterday at Clackamas Town and how within, it seemed, minutes, they had the SWAT teams they had. And I was driving down Division. I saw this big white truck, and I'm sure a SWAT team was in that one, heading down Division and so those types of incidents, obviously, we have a mechanism in to respond, but on a massive, I mean, it's just so hard for me to comprehend, on massive destruction like this.
Vice Chair, one of the highlights of yesterday, if there could be one, there were six tactical response vehicles that we're able to communicate between federal jurisdictions, counties, and locals. Out of those, all of those have been funded out of FEMA grants and stuff in the past for interoperability and communication. So if nothing else, we do have some good lessons learned from an isolated incident like that, in that those were funded out of Homeland Security funds, either by part or by whole, depending on how they were funded. But it allowed them to respond quickly, stage so they weren't tramping all over each other, and allow that lead agency, which in this case was Clackamas County, to do their job and assign tasks.
Just follow up on, I mean, were they HF, VHF, if the system collapsed, would they still be able to communicate? Because they would be stuck, frankly, the reality is in Portland, they'd be stuck within bridges.
Most of the command vehicles have both UHF, VHF, and what's now called narrow banding in the 700 megahertz, mm-hmm. which is going to be the new mandate. So most of them have a variety of both, mainly because the geography in Oregon demands it. We don't have the luxury of a very flat state so that we can settle for one. So it's forced those agencies to have a multitude. But we still will run into that overwhelming of the communication system on a large-scale incident.
And then to include satellites, that's also part of the mix. Our 102nd CST team has all of that in one vehicle, and they got a multiple that can actually decouple and go mm-hmm. on the ground, basically, the GISC system and some other things. We didn't have that in 1996. We didn't even have that in 2007. So we've made, I think, across the board, great strides to improving that communication network. Of course, the best test is something like this, and that'll test it right to its max. Had it not been for ham radios in 2007, we wouldn't have been able to talk to the North Oregon coast.
That's right, but that's 10 years. We learned nothing. We didn't accomplish anything in 10 years, other than the fact we still have the phone number for the ham radio operator. Right?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we actually did accomplish something. After that, Governor Kulongoski made an effort, and we actually funded new ham radio setups for counties. Mm-hmm. And we have since got them out to most, I think all 36 counties have got a new upgraded ham radio system. Now, it's 1930 technology, but it works. It's not secure.
Was there a formula as how many ham radios per population in the county?
Madam Vice Chair, no, we did one for each county emergency manager to have that available. So we knew that it was up to date. It was state-of-the-art, and that they could actually, and we test it on a regular basis, so we know that it's still up and running. It's just a backup system to everything else, because we learned, not the hard way, but thank God we had it in 2007, and it worked like a charm. So we said, you know, we don't need to buy every whiz-bang toy out there. If this thing's working, let's make sure we got that as a backup. The other stuff's better. It's secure. You get more data. You can do a lot of things on it, but ham works very well. So we're going to continue to work that. We have a room sitting in our ECC, in our Air Emergency Communications Center, that's dedicated to ham radios and how that works, and works for Marty right now. And they, you know, it's there for use and practicing and exercising and during the event. So we believe in that system. We believe in all of them, but this is our solid core backup.
It worked in World War II, so it's going to work. That's the problem.
And we're looking at carrier pigeons, so right. No.
the cell system, I would think at some point, and I don't know what our laws are, and we haven't really gone beyond this, but we've talked about cows when it goes out, but there's the reverse that you just brought up, Colonel, is that you can overload the system, and so mm-hmm. therefore nobody's able to use it, and the question is what is the allocation law, or what is the authority to say, all right, look, we got to shut down entire sectors or whole sets of numbers in order to be able to have what is left still functioning. And I don't know where we are in that discussion with the cell structure or the cellular companies.
I would think, though, with technology, I mean, I still think we're in the infancy of our technology, mm-hmm. and who knows in 10 years what the capacity will be. Right now we don't have it, though.
Chairman Boquist and Vice Chair Anderson, what we do have that is in place and pretty common in the first responder community is what's called GETS cards, and those put a priority. So if you call and use that code, I can bump 10 other users off so that I can make my call. And almost all first responders, the majority of the emergency manager fields have those. The thing that we're studying at this point is, do we have too many of them, and are we going to bump ourselves off at this point? And so that's one of the concerns that only exercises and those types of things will actually demonstrate for us. But we do have an ability to limit, so to speak, or at least get a prioritization on some of that communication as it's needed.
If it's still standing.
Right.
Yeah.
And hasn't been severed.
So we have to go to satellite.
Which we have that.
We have that as well.
We have that as well, and we have our major vehicles and command vehicles, individuals. We carry satellite phones, and we keep them with us constantly because you don't know when you may need it. Mm-hmm. And I always take mine if I'm going to the coast. That's the first thing I pack up, you know, make sure I've got my sat phone. So that's just some of the and I can't say that every county has that. Because they are rather expensive to purchase, and some of the grants have been able to buy them. But then you got to maintain that link with the satellite company, which can get rather onerous. And I found that out when I was testing mine, and 3 weeks later, the people that pay the bills came up and said, "What are you doing on that phone?" I said, "Well, I'll just make sure it worked." And, "Well, don't do it again unless you need it, because it costs more money when you do that."
Mm-hmm.
But it works.
Mm-hmm. Senator Olson, no question. Vice Chair. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Are we ready for World War II now? If we can dim the lights. And we'll run the tape, and then you can do a close on that. I think we're multitasking.
I wanted to get in the military so bad that I could taste it. So I joined up the National Guard. This was back in the latter part of 1939.
I enlisted 3 months after I turned 17. The war was still on.
It was not something that you had to do. It was something that you wanted to do.
It was the thing to do, but back then it was your duty.
I lied about my age. I was 15. It was wartime, and I wanted to fight in the war before it was over.
I was 19. I wanted to serve the country.
We felt sorry for the people who didn't have the opportunity to serve.
About 150,000 Oregonians served in World War II.
3,750 gave their lives, men and women. They did a tremendous amount for our country and for the freedoms that we have.
A good friend of mine, a fraternity brother, initiated with me, and he wrote me what they call V-mail. He isn't very pretty over here, he said. And then he said, "I never knew how much I wanted to live till I got over here." Well, he didn't live much longer. When I tell you that story, how many more stories just like that? And that's what war's all about.
We started up this hill. We were constantly harassed by snipers. And I was losing guys like the devil. I lost my platoon sergeant, my guide sergeant, my radio operator, my runner. When I finally got a radio, the radio operator, lost my whole platoon headquarters, plus probably half a dozen other guys. And it was bad.
Our division liberated the Ohrdruf concentration camp. And seeing these half-dead people, the bodies were lined up like railroad ties, and the smell of lime, and that was the worst.
I was wounded on the fifth day of the battle for Iwo Jima. Mortar hit fairly close to me, and it cut the nerves, so I didn't have any pain in my arm. It also blew all the skin off my chest. The only time I cried during battle was to carry me off the battlefield. I looked up and saw the Marines raising the flag. Seeing the American flag raising at that time was overwhelming.
these are incredible stories of people homegrown here in Oregon that you know, have a lot to share.
There were plenty of folks who gave a lot, who were on the home front. They didn't have to be in uniform. They were doing things for the war effort.
It wasn't just the soldiers and the sailors and the Marines out there doing the fighting. It was everybody fighting in their own way. The whole United States was in on this.
I think there were a lot more people than we know about on the home front who sacrificed a lot.
People of my generation and younger have no notion of what shared sacrifice is about, what, you know, what it means for an entire country to come together with a singular purpose to achieve a common goal. The world would have been vastly different had the United States and its allies not prevailed.
There are memorials for World War I, for the Korean War, for the Vietnam War, but there has been nothing for World War II.
There's all kinds of memorials to World War I, Civil War and whatnot, but it seems there isn't really a memorial to World War II.
For Oregon not to have a memorial for World War II veterans, shame on us.
Oregon is one of six states that does not have such a memorial, and Governor Kuligowski and his staff really started this process.
Through the hard work of a lot of people, they've come up with a very compelling design for it.
The memorial will reside in what's called Wilson Park on the corner of Court and Cottage on the Capitol grounds.
We've designed it to become part of the park, to flow evenly with the pathways and the look of the Capitol building.
The footprint will be 75 foot square. At the center of this footprint will be a 33 foot high five-sided obelisk, 33 feet high because Oregon's the 33rd state of the nation.
And I think that's appropriate. Some symbolism, but it's a symbolism beyond what our eyes will see.
Along two sides of the memorial will be low black granite walls with the names of the fallen.
We'll also have on the grounds, which is all granite, a world map.
And in that map will be notations for each theater of war in which we fought.
As part of the educational aspects to this memorial, we're going to be using QR codes strategically placed around there so the younger generation with their smartphones and iPads will be able to key in on a different part of it and get a full story.
The memorial, by its design, will not just be a static memorial. We'll have an opportunity to educate future generations and tell these stories.
We're really excited about this bit of technology that us older generations sometimes don't fully appreciate.
I feel strongly that if we can inspire one person to greatness in this generation, the next generation, two generations from now, this memorial will be well worth it. This is not about glorifying war. It's not about glorifying military might. Frankly, it's about glorifying the human spirit and what one can do if one must do it.
Well, I think it's important to remember our generation and our sacrifices.
The day of the dedication, with any luck, we will have a number of World War II veterans in attendance. And I know that the look on their face will make all this effort well worth it.
I'd like to see that built immediately before we all die.
I'm going to hit the big 9 in February. You better hurry. You better go raise that money quickly.
I'd like to come when they unveil it. I'd probably visit it 2 or 3 times more. You go there and you see a guy's name, it makes a difference.
I think it's very significant for people my age who were just born at that time in the early 40s to remember what our parents and grandparents did for us, so we have the freedom that we have today. That's why it's important to give money to the memorial, so you become part of the memorial, literally, and part of the people who went forward for us, who sacrificed literally their lives so we could have the freedom today.
Yeah, I would encourage everyone to make a donation so that this gets built before all of us leave this world.
Thank you for your attention. That's what we're about, and we believe there's a lot on the line here to honor that generation, and we appreciate your support.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your hard work, Kevin.
Thank you.
And where is it going? Where is it?
On the corner of Court and Cottage.
Court.
It's in the Capitol Mall right out here.
Capitol Mall.
We've already done a groundbreaking.
Yeah, I knew there was a groundbreaking. For some reason, I didn't realize.
Well, that was more symbolic. We didn't have enough money to start digging and then leave an empty hole there for until we had enough money. But we've raised with commitments, with commitments and the $250,000 before the state legislature, we probably need another $500,000, $600,000. So it's not a lot of money. That's what everybody tells me, but getting that money is another matter. We're working hard at it. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Caucus gave $10,000, our caucus would give $10,000.
That concludes the items that are on the agenda. I'd like to thank Senator Courtney for her service on the committee during the 2 years as we come to an end, and thank Senator Olson and Senator Mona Sanderson, and I'd like to thank our good legal counsel and Cheyenne, and I'd like to thank all the members, and I'd like to thank the public for their participation.
Well,
and with that,
you.
We will, unless anybody has anything to say, we'll go to an end. Mm-hmm.